And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg and Mark Mulcahy.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Thank you for all the emails that we've received. Mike from Pasadena, California writes us, I was going to apply for a farm apprenticeship this summer and now heard that there are legal issues about interning at an organic farm. Could you please shed light on this topic? Yes, great question. Well, there's nothing new about the legislation, actually. Nothing has changed. But it is true that unpaid apprenticeships at farms, organic farms or non-organic, may violate the existing state laws that we have in the state of California. State labor law states that if a person provides services of economic value to the employer has to comply with the state's labor law requirements and must allow breaks and guarantee a safe workplace, pay at least minimum wage and workers' comp and state taxes. Every state in the United States has different labor laws regulating farm interns. And Washington State, for example, just passed a modified language in this regard. But currently in the state of California, if you want to spend the summer working at an organic farm or a non-organic farm, even if your intention is to learn, if you provide labor that would otherwise require the hiring of a worker, you very likely will need to be treated as a farm worker, and calling it an unpaid apprenticeship could be illegal. So please check with your state departments of labor before you reach out to a farm, or if you are a farmer thinking of having interns or offering apprenticeship opportunities on your farm or ranch this summer, also please check with your specific state's Department of Labor and look up the requirements and the language. Thank you, Mike from Pasadena, California, for this very important question. If you have a comment or question, please email us at share@anorganicconversation.com. Mark, how was your week?
It was wow. That's going to have a huge impact on organic farmers, isn't it? Or it could.
Yeah, again, there's nothing new about this legislation. This was originally put in place to protect immigrating farm workers, or okay. Anyone working at farms. And yet you're right. The entire movement here, in the organic movement, the food movement now, is based on or very much supported by this interest of people wanting to reconnect to land, mm-hmm. wanting to spend a summer or a month or, you know, a few weeks helping out at a farm, reconnecting to the way the food is grown, understanding that, learning that. And, there are some areas where if it's really based on a curriculum where maybe if you're enrolled in a university that offers an internship, summer internship at a farm, that might be exempt in that case. But if you just come in and you really want to help and you basically are working for a summer at a farm, that has to be paid labor. There's not much wiggle room in the state of California. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other states, have their own regulations, but it's, with the current financial crisis in California, all those areas, whether it's at a farm or working anywhere else, really, is being very much looked at right now. So we don't want anyone to get in trouble, neither the farmer nor the apprentice or the person interested in spending their summer at a farm.
And so many of our friends who've created organic farms around the country have, actually started as an apprentice and then became some of the best organic farmers that we know of.
Yeah, and I do think there needs to be an adjustment. I mean, the law is usually there to protect the people that are not protected by law
before.
So it's a good intention, but at this point, with this movement and this massive interest of people coming back to the land, I think there has to be an adjustment. And actually, Marin Organic is one of the several organizations that is working on looking at the language that was just passed in Washington State, adjusting to current conditions a little bit more accurately and appropriately, perhaps. And if we can find language for the state of California, that would be important, because this is, one of the number one agricultural states in the nation for sure. And also because of that, there are many different interests of many different people, and we need to make sure that what may help the organic food movement does not violate or jeopardize other areas.
Oh, so, absolutely.
You know, it's always very complex and tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great question. It was a great question.
Well, how was your week?
So, yeah, I didn't answer, but I just had to comment on.
Yeah, you know, it's a huge topic. We'll stay on it.
Week was great. You know, I mean, we did a great show last weekend. I really loved that show, Organic on a Budget. That was just a ball.
Yes.
That was just really fun to do with Amay and Jenny. And then the week was great because this week I had my first of the year, Chermoya.
Arguably one of my absolutely favorite foods. If it's kind of a food where when you look at it, my first initial take on it was I wanted to stay away from it because simply I didn't know what it was. And it looks like a petrified dinosaur, or it looks like a dinosaur and a turtle had a good time at one point, or it's kind of undefinable. You don't know what you can expect inside, but whoever had not had a cherimoya is kind of this very dark greenish tree-like
kind of looks like a heart-shaped,
as big as your fist, the one you have right now. They get a little bit bigger, but tropical fruit that has like this dinosaur skin to it.
Yeah, I actually think it looks like scales. Clay, like if you were molding clay, and they look like fingerprints all over the whole thing from molding clay.
Yeah. But then you open it up, which we will maybe at the end of the show, and I just saw the first organic cherimoyas coming in now in April for a couple of weeks now, and unbelievable flavor. It's like this kind of chewing gummy, yummy. I actually don't know the health benefits. We should look those up.
Chewing gummy, yummy?
Yeah, but it doesn't even matter. I'm sure it's good for you. But the flavor of a cherimoya is, I love mango. I love tropical fruit, but this is my favorite.
Growing up with it in Germany so much.
There's nothing like it, right? Yeah. There's nothing close to, you can't really explain. Your cherimoya is kind of like a pear meeting
Yeah.
Nothing like it. Cherimoya is so yummy, not overly sweet, and just
Well, if we have time, we'll eat this, and then you could try to describe it on the air later at the end of the show.
Did you get that from Earl's?
I don't think we got this from Earl's this week, but this we got this from down at the stores, and they used to only be produced in Mexico. Now they're being produced in California.
Oh, really?
And so these are coming from Southern California,
more localer,
closer.
Nice.
And so, yeah, they're very nice. And they're like $6.99 a pound, but it's worth every single bite.
Penny, yes.
Yes.
So great show with Earl Herrick from Earl's Organic Produce a couple of weeks ago on citrus. And you pointed out last week's show on organic on a budget. Lots of comments came in. We will discuss those next week. But very concrete tips on how to eat more healthfully and actually perhaps even save money. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Here on Organic Conversation, I'm super excited about our guests today as we are talking about food that is grown culturally appropriate and socially just, mm-hmm. so important and often overlooked. The world of reciprocity. More about that in a minute when we come back. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Here on Green 960, we'll be right back after the break.
Ooh, I want you so badly. It's my biggest wish.
Cool. I spend my time just thinking about you. Every single day, guess I'm really missing you. And all those things we used to do. Hey girl, what's up? It used to be just me and you.
I spend my time just thinking about you. Every single day, guess I'm really missing you. And all those things we used to do. Hey girl, what's up, girl? What's up, what's up, what's up?
Can you meet me halfway? Right up the borderline is where I'm going away. For you, I'll be looking out night and day.
And we're back here to An Organic Conversation on Green 960. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And with us on the phone is Rob Everts, co-president and co-executive director of Equal Exchange, a certification agency ensuring that our coffee, chocolate, and tea, among other products, are grown culturally appropriate and socially just. Thanks for being on the show today, Rob.
My pleasure.
Great to have you. So, you know, we were just discussing in this mini break, Mark and I, that, you know, people, organic or not, the food you see in the supermarket, other than through your label, is absolutely not identified in how it is grown, maybe in an environmental sense, but not in a cultural sense. Tell us what fair trade and equal exchange guarantees.
Yeah, that's a good point of entry for why Equal Exchange was even founded, because it was started by three guys in 1986 back here in the East Coast who had worked for many years with food co-ops and in food distribution, and realized how divorced people were from where food came from and sourced under what conditions, especially products that came from overseas. And so Equal Exchange was founded and was the first organization to bring the concept of fair trade into the food world. And in our product, the initial product was coffee, so food and beverage world. It was started to bring consumers and small-scale producers both literally and figuratively closer together. So they looked at the prevailing model of trade, which was essentially the race to the bottom, where importers of anything would look around the world for the cheapest possible price and import it and turn it around and mark it up as high as the market would bear. And especially in the commodities such as coffee and cacao, small-scale producers were very much at the mercy of the whiplash of the pricing, you know, due to both supply and demand, weather, and in no small part, speculation. But the other reason, and that this is just instrumental in what Equal Exchange has now done for 24 years, was to engage consumers. Like, engage consumers not only to question where things come from and under what conditions, but also to provide an alternative in the market. So it's one thing to be against this, or, you know, don't buy this and don't buy that, but it was also a key part of the driving mission originally, and still is, to provide alternatives to what we don't like, so that there's something affirmative that consumers can, with, you know, some confidence, put their money behind, knowing that that there's more justice behind the dollars that are spent on product A over product B.
Yes, and it's kind of sad. I mean, besides, it's really important work, but it's kind of sad that for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, trade was a cultural exchange, right? You didn't just bring foods, potatoes to England and then didn't talk about who grew them and what. If you really look at what trade allowed us to do, it was to getting to know cultures hundreds of years ago that we otherwise would never have the chance to experience. Mm-hmm. Through their goods. And mm-hmm. and then somehow that got lost along the way. What was your motivation, or the people who started it 24 years ago, that's almost ahead of your time, right, in a funny way? I mean, it got lost. It was tradition for hundreds of years to make it a cultural exchange. Then it got lost. And then 24 years ago, that was even before the food movement, you guys already had the awareness to make it about that again, to talk about labor conditions, to talk about really the whole nine yards, the whole enchilada, if we're talking about food, from the coffee worker to the working conditions, to child labor, all that is covered. What's the personal motivation to make that, you know, a business or
yeah,
an agency?
No, there was the food and the cultural piece, and then add into that rich mixture in the moment, right? There was geopolitics, and in our case, right, there was the U.S. Policy in Central America. So these guys were foodies, and most of us are foodies. I've been here 13 years, and so we do have a direct connection and a love for food. And at the same time, most of us have come out of another background as well, and that is the social justice movement. And so we, for example, saw what U.S. policy was doing in Central America, and it was not an accident that the very first product that Equal Exchange imported, which poetically arrived after eluding a Reagan-imposed embargo in Nicaragua, was a container of coffee from Nicaragua when it was under the Sandinista government in 1986 as a direct challenge, right, to U.S. policy. So it was a food product, but it was a political statement. It was a statement, really a declaration of solidarity with the poor of that country. And to this day, Equal Exchange is looking for opportunities to reflect the cultural value that you speak of by buying from many indigenous organizations, cooperatives made up of indigenous groups in different parts of the world, from Bolivia to Chiapas to Colombia and elsewhere, and as a way to enable people to stay on the land, essentially. If you look at, you know, what this experiment has done over the last 20 years or so, you can look at concrete benefits.
I was just going to ask you, Rob, you know, what... actually, I have a couple of questions, but since you were going there, one of my questions was going to be, what actually have you seen? What actually concrete changes have you seen from your work with Equal Exchange? And how do people know whether that what fair, you know, how is it certified that it actually is doing what you're doing when they're buying these products?
Yeah, great questions. For starters, I'd probably put the gains, the successes in this, you know, arc of history of our experience here in four categories. First is very tangible. So we can go to places now where we've been buying from. And again, we buy from organized groups of small farmers because we believe that's the best path. These cooperatives are the best representative agents in the rural developing world to represent the hopes and aspirations of the rural poor. And so when we look, we've seen tangible benefits such as people who are able to send their kids to secondary school when they couldn't before, people who have been able to open health clinics, schools in communities, potable drinking water where they didn't have it and where the government doesn't extend that kind of social benefit there. So there's some tangible things like that. I've been to a place where people actually have concrete floors instead of mud before, when I've gone back years later. That's one. Second would be that these power structures or the power in communities, right? In many of these areas, it's dominated by large plantation owners, oligarchs, and sometimes in some of these countries, some of the worst human rights violators that you can imagine. And in many of the crops that we deal with, there are organized groups, usually that take the form of cooperatives. And when we've seen, whereas, for example, many years ago, they could not get a loan from a local bank because they were deemed too high risk. Now, many of those groups who we've extended pre-financing for contracts of coffee and cacao, they're established enough, having had this long-term relationship as institutions, to command local financing on terms that are acceptable from local institutions or international institutions that they could not access before. The third is a more fundamental thing, I would say, and that is impossible to quantify, but there are countless thousands of small-scale farmers from Chiapas, Mexico, to Ecuador, who simply have been able to stay on the land instead of head into the capital city or in many cases, in our case, come north, you know, and work in the fields of the San Joaquin Valley or wash dishes in a restaurant. They've been able to just stay on the land, which would be their preference to do. And the fourth area would be consumers, that there is now, in many ways, we were not an idea whose time had come, when people weren't even talking about free trade and the problems there before the concept of fair trade we put in their lap. And so now there's this many, many more consumers who are connecting the dots and who are asking those kind of questions and making demands from stores to demonstrate where their things come from.
Rob Everts, co-president and co-executive director of Equal Exchange, a certification agency ensuring that our coffee, chocolate, and tea and many other products are grown culturally appropriate and socially just. Rob, stay on the phone. We'll take a quick break, and then we want to know, you're not just paying more money, you're also making sure that certain other criteria are upheld in order for somebody to call themselves Equal Exchange Certified Fair Trade. So stay on the phone. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. We'll be right back after the break.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Spotica Skincare. Founded by Janet Leigh Katzen, Spotica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Spotica Skincare products and the Spotica Spa, visit spotica.com. That's SPHATIKA.com.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family-owned and operated since 1942, a West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Marin Organic, an association of organic food producers in Marin County, California, is helping to create a healthy and sustainable food shed just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. A model for how to feed a region in a way that is economically viable, environmentally sound, socially just, and culturally appropriate. The opportunity to change the world is right on our plates. Be a part of the solution. For more information on Marin Organic and how to support its efforts, visit marinorganic.org.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
In Green 960. And today we're looking at food being grown culturally appropriate and socially just. On the phone with us still is Rob Everts, originally from Mill Valley, California, the co-executive director and co-president of Equal Exchange, a certification agency ensuring that our coffee, chocolate, and many other products meet those criteria that we will be discussing now. Rob, before the break, you said the biggest impacts you see through Equal Exchange is improved living conditions, perhaps improvements in the infrastructure in those countries of people, co-ops mostly, that are part of Equal Exchange, then a restructuring of the power where it's not just the owner of large amounts of land getting most of the money or all of the money, and then the actual worker is left with next to nothing. Then thousands of farmers actually being able to stay on the land over the last 24 years since Equal Exchange started their important work. And of course, consumer education. You mentioned free trade and now fair trade. Free trade often being kind of the opposite of fair trade. Do you want to speak on that? How do you ensure, what's the certification process? You're not just ensuring that people get a few pennies more per pound or per sack of goods that you buy that carry your label, but also they have to meet certain criteria. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, in fact, let me clarify one thing before going forward. Equal Exchange itself isn't a certifier. We were the first to do it, and we're probably the largest organization that does exclusively business on these terms. We are a business. We happen to be an alternative structured business, a worker-owned cooperative ourselves, whose mission and is to develop fair trade and to support small farmers, And we're,
yeah, thanks for clarifying that. You're really, you're a trade association, right?
We're a business. Yeah. We're an importer and a wholesaler, and we put things out under our brand. We market coffee and chocolate products and tea and bananas now under the Equal Exchange brand. Yeah. And so the commitment as fair traders that we make is yes to a price that enables people to survive, that exceeds the cost of production for sure, in an additional social premium per pound, and it's different by crop, for development in their community. We commit to buy direct instead of through myriad brokers and intermediaries, so we shorten the chain. We extend what's vital in agriculture everywhere is pre-harvest financing, so that when people have no access to cash, they can still do the necessary work to prepare a quality export product. And we also commit to long-term trade relationships. I would say, to sum it up, the key is the relationship. It's about representing in the marketplace here the interests of small producers, in our case, small producers overseas, family farmers overseas, who have, absent this kind of system, no access to people like you and I, no access to consumers in the United States. And so that's our role.
And so, Rob, how much does that work out to? I mean, you said it changed for different crops, you know, what you give. But on an average, like if you were going into a coffee growing area, someone who's just grown, someone who might be just growing it for a plantation or for another organization, and compared to what your coffee workers are getting?
Yeah, good question, and a tough one to answer. To be very crude, if we're paying a cooperative something like $2 a pound for coffee, a farmer might get $1.40 of that, and maybe the rest would go to support the co-op and build the infrastructure and maintain, you know, the export and all that kind of stuff. Whereas someone who's unaffiliated with a co-op but still a small-scale producer might get way less than that. What happens is people in these remote rural areas, let's say small coffee farmers, if you're not part of a system like this, you're a price taker, and there's people who roam those mountainsides with cash, and they know that people are poor. And the deal is essentially this: you're poor, we both know it, here's some cash for your coffee beans, take it or leave it. And more often than not, people are forced to take it, and it's less. So it comes out to substantially less. We just had from some cacao producers from the Dominican Republic, a cooperative called Conocado, here in Boston last week, who are telling us that right now they're getting more like... They're getting approximately double the price that people who are not in the fair trade system get for cacao, and it gets into metric tons and things like that. So I probably won't go way down that path, but substantially more. But it's about a price, because price matters. But really, it's about a lot more than that. And just because I know your audience could appreciate this, I want to say that fair trade is a compelling component of the solution, right? But as you look back at the trajectory over the last 20 years, you see many, many people all over the world in rural areas who, many of whom are in less good condition than they were 20 years ago, right? And why is that? It's largely because of massive consolidation in the food system, which has really... marginalize the smallest producers, and it's the trade agreements like NAFTA, which are usually structured at the benefit of the large-scale producers and the big multinationals here, as opposed to the small-scale producers. So fair trade is a really great, tangible component of the solution, but there's also policy and legislative needs as well in the mix. Mm-hmm.
And then for all that work that you do, how does that work out to the dollar that we spend on Equal Exchange, Fair Trade certified, for example, coffee? If you spend twice as much per metric ton of coca, chocolate, or coffee, that's penny to the cup, right?
It's really very little. Like, to get right down to it, if you're spending $8 for a pound of coffee, I'm saying two only. Even this, under fair trade, is going to a producer co-op, right? Because then you have transport, you have the processing, you have the drying, the processing of it, the export, the shipping, the insurance, the storage, the delivery, the transport, you know, the changing it from a green coffee bean into a roasted product.
Right.
So there is a lot there, but what we really try to do is shorten the chain and take and eliminate some of the players who play no affirmative role in this process and go as direct as possible from producer to consumer.
Right. So even on the price point for the end consumer, it's often almost the same, or it is the same. And because you have a direct access and help these coffee thinkers and farm workers directly, and offer an alternative, you avoid the middleman. And because of that, you can pay a substantial amount more per good.
Yes. Uh-huh.
How can people find you? How can people support you? We can find Equal Exchange fairly traded coffee at any good grocery store, but you also have online sales. Is that right? You do sell directly?
Yeah, locally, for sure in the Bay Area, you find us at Rainbow Co-op and down at New Leaf. You can go to equalexchange.coop.
Uh-huh.
COOP, to find much more out about Equal Exchange and where we can be found locally. You can purchase our products online, and you can learn much more about what's behind your cup of coffee, what's behind your cup of tea, your chocolate bar, and things like that.
Great. Equalexchange.coop.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, for joining us today. Rob Everts, the co-president and co-executive director of Equal Exchange, an agency ensuring that your coffee, chocolate, tea, and bananas, among many other products, are grown culturally appropriate and socially just. And it's really a business. You're not a nonprofit. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so
our mission is nonprofit, but we are strict as a for-profit, and that means we need to play by the same rules as other businesses.
Which is really, you know, that social awareness and that social responsibility, it will come back to us anyway. So I think it's our responsibility that we know where our food comes from, how it is grown, and that the people who grew it, whether it's 50 miles away or 5,000 miles away, are treated in a way that, you know, can let us sleep and make us feel good, of course.
You know, and just to top that off is, I think it's important that we recognize that when you're doing the good work that you're doing is that someone who is doing your work also makes a wage that they can live on too, so that they can continue to do that good work. Often in this movement that I've been part of for so many years, people have sacrificed, you know, their own personal needs, and I think it's good to recognize that it's okay for someone to make a living while doing this good work too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, keep it up. Rob Everts, again, co-executive director and co-president of Equal Exchange. You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we're looking at food that is grown culturally appropriate and socially just. And our next guest calling in from Devonport is Jim Cochran, co-owner and president of Swanton Berry Farm. Jim, welcome to the show. Jim, do we have you on the show? Maybe not right now, but he will be.
And I can say while we're waiting for Jim to chime in here, is I've known Jim for probably 25 years. I took my daughters when they were just babies, and we did a farm tour. One of the first farm tours I ever led was out to Swanton Berry Farm, and we literally went out there and were picking strawberries with a group of Good Nature Grocery customers. We just had them all pack up in the cars. We drove down to Davenport from Walnut Creek and walked the fields, and it was a great, great experience.
And that was before Jim offered chocolate dipped strawberries.
that was long before
farm
Jim.
Stand.
Yes, it was the same farm, but it was before he was offering chocolate dipped strawberries. Yes.
So second try now. Joining us on the phone from Devonport, California, Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swanton Berry Farm, a certified organic strawberry farm in Devonport, and also the first to join the Farm Workers Union. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much.
How is the weather down in Devonport right now?
Oh, boy, it's perfect strawberry weather.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's sunny, and Not too warm and not too cold.
Oh my God! So we are expecting a good crop this year.
Well,
so
of course,
far,
so far, so good. You know, it looks beautiful. The plants loved all the rain we got, and now they're ready for sunshine. So,
so how long? When did you start Swantonberry, and what was your intention?
Well, I started back in 1983, and I had a partner at the time, and our intention was to try to grow strawberries without fumigating with methyl bromide and using all the chemicals.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about the effects of methyl bromide on as global warming continues, and why is methyl bromide such an issue in conventional strawberry production?
Well, first of all, methyl bromide is a fumigant that is used also in fumigating houses for termites. And it is a chemical which is extremely reactive, and that's what makes it so such an effective soil fumigant, because it sort of attaches itself to just about anything that's in the soil and throws its function off. And so it destroys weed seeds and all a large spectrum of pathogens and so forth. That's the
quote-unquote benefit.
That's the the conventional farmers would call a benefit.
Yeah.
And the downside to that is that it also does the same thing in the atmosphere. And it gets up into the upper atmosphere, and it reacts with all sorts of different of the chemicals in the upper atmosphere, and wreaks havoc up there because it's such a highly reactive chemical. And so it's been important to get a ban on that chemical, because that's it has a very large environmental disruptive effect.
And so you knew pretty much right away from the get-go that you wanted to grow organic strawberries.
Yes.
And you found a way to do it without methyl bromide, right? It's often when we are entrepreneurs,
right,
and pioneers in that area, people say you can't do it, even though for hundreds of years strawberries have been grown before we invented methyl bromide. And then what do you do in order to avoid what methyl bromide
would
deal
with? Well, it took about 5 or 10 years to figure out the best methodology.
Uh-huh.
And actually, the first year, my partner was more inclined to use chemicals, and I was less. And so we did 50-50. We fumigated half the field and watched the results. But we got good enough results without fumigating that we dropped it after the second year. So then we embarked on our organic certification. And so we became certified in 1987. So originally we were, because nobody had ever grown strawberries on a commercial basis from scratch, from a plant, organically. So people had done a little bit of growing on pieces of land that had been fumigated originally, but were not sprayed for a year, and those in that time was eligible to be called organic. But in our view, it was really more appropriate to start on ground that had not been fumigated in the first place.
Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swantonberry Farm, a certified organic strawberry farm in Davenport, California, and also the first to join the Farm Workers Union. And we want to talk about that with you, Jim, right after the break, because organic, even though in the definition of organic, it does mention culturally appropriate methods, but it doesn't really by law spell out anything in regard to farm worker legislation or the fair treatment of workers. And that was a really, really important point for you when you joined the Farm Workers Union. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. We'll take a quick break. My name is Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960, and we'll be right back.
to you? What did you give to me? A nothing trail of silences that warp in the rain. You said I don't really know the reason. It's just not the same. Oh, what a vacant breath of wind when you say my name. And do you know that I'm
an organic conversation is brought to you by Spotica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Spotica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Spotica skincare products and the Spotica Spa, visit spotica.com. That's SPHATIKA.com.
Hi, my name is Earl Herrick. I started Earl's Organic Produce over 20 years ago to bring the best certified organic produce to the San Francisco Bay Area. Still today, Earl's Organic Produce is sourcing only organic fruits and vegetables. Our core principle is healthy relationships with growers, the environment, and the clients we serve. If you are a business interested in offering the most delicious organic produce to your customers, please visit us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Are you looking for a romantic and unusual location in the Bay Area for your wedding or upcoming anniversary? Toby's Feed Barn offers the perfect venue for your celebration. A rustic barn in the heart of beautiful West Marin, with local organic caterers ready to delight your guests amid bales of hay. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. Open 7 days a week. Family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Hi, I'm Peter Walsh. My wife and I founded Manika Jewelry with the intention to offer a different kind of jewelry. Beautiful, made by local Bay Area artists, and without a social or environmental compromise. Our featured designers use reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly-certified gemstones. It's jewelry made with heart and soul. Come visit our store just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco. Or visit our website at manikajewelry.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Here on Green 960. And today we are talking about the world of reciprocity. Making sure that our food is grown not just environmentally sustainable, but also culturally appropriate and socially just. We heard from Rob Everts, co-president and co-executive director of Equal Exchange, before the half hour. And now on the phone with us still is Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swantonberry Farm, a certified organic strawberry farm in Davenport, California, and also the first to join the Farm Workers Union here in the state. Jim, I just had one of your strawberries. Mark brought up strawberries on his way up yesterday. Tiny, beautifully red little packets of flavor. What are we eating? What's the variety right now that you're harvesting?
Those are Chandler's.
My favorite.
Really?
My favorite strawberry.
Incredibly sweet already. We are talking April 10th today, Saturday, and people can buy them at your farm stand right at the farm.
Right.
And in selected grocery stores, right? Here in the Bay Area, where would we find those?
Not quite yet in the grocery stores. We have them in the farmers markets.
Oh, great.
Already. And they will be making their way into the grocery stores over the next few weeks. They will be at Rainbow and Monterey Market and Whole Foods markets and a few others.
And for listeners outside the state, sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But you can go to swantonberryfarm.com and see all the market locations, the farmer's market stands, and the directions to the farm. Jim, it was always important to you that to address something that the organic rule touches on. It says it needs to be culturally appropriate growing methods, but it really doesn't address farm worker issues or the rights of farm workers. And you joined the Farm Workers Union. Tell us what motivated you to do that, and what does that mean? What do you guarantee your workers that other farms may not?
Well, it's precisely for the reason that you stated, which is to say that the organic label doesn't say anything at all about labor practices. And I felt that labor practices were just as important, if not sometimes more important, than cultural practices. And so that's the point at which we entered into negotiations with the United Farm Workers, in part also because Cesar Chavez had always been interested in organic farming, in part as a way to, or largely as a way to help farm workers avoid pesticide exposures.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, Rob Everts, who we had on the show earlier, actually in the 70s worked with the United Farm Workers Union under Cesar Chavez. So there's a full loop. And what does that mean now for you? You are a member. You are upholding their...
Well, we have a contract. We've had a contract with them for, 11 years or something like that, a long time. And it's worked out very well. We provide a health plan and a dental plan and vacation pay, holiday pay, and a pension plan through the union contract, so as well as a profit sharing plan. So it's quite a comprehensive program. And it talks not only about the benefits, but also about procedures for hiring and firing people. Talks about seniority issues and job assignment issues. And it's quite a comprehensive plan. It's sort of like negotiating a HR, human relations department. It's quite a positive thing. It brings the agricultural enterprise into at least the 20th century, maybe not quite the 21st century yet, but takes us out of the 19th century anyway.
And it's really about relationships, right? I mean, when we grow food, it's about the relationship with the land, and of course, all the people that grow it, all the people that trade it. Fairly return to the farmer if you own your own land or be part of an operation like yours. Many organic farms or small-scale farms uphold some of the criteria. It's fair to say, though, that the vast majority of farm workers here in the state and throughout the U.S. don't enjoy these benefits that they should be enjoying. How much is covered through state labor laws? We had that as the intro. Somebody was asking about apprenticeships at farms this summer, and there are certain labor law restrictions that would that this person as an apprentice at a farm would fall under now. Mm-hmm. How much is covered of what you see the union contract that you have provides or requires for you to do compared to what the state, in this case California, would put on you as a minimum requirement that you offer your farm workers?
Well, the minimum requirement by the state of California is really not, doesn't amount to a huge amount. And furthermore, there's very little enforcement. Mm-hmm. So the contract with the union goes a great deal further than the state requirements for various labor issues. So it's quite a bit more comprehensive.
And so it's more expensive for you, of course, to offer this.
Quite a bit more.
How do you compensate for that? How is your operation structured that you can do it? Do you get benefits from the union back in terms of marketing? And of course, you can say that you're doing this, and hopefully people recognize this.
I think we have a loyal customer base among people who recognize that that is an important thing to them, that they are concerned about the food that they are buying is grown under proper labor conditions. So it's helpful in that way. But
I bet your strawberries are not more expensive, really.
No, they're not more expensive, no. So one thing that helps, I suppose, is that we do not own our land, so we don't have land payments. We're a pretty bare-bones company. You know, we own a bunch of sprinkler pipe and some tractors.
And you're leasing the land.
But we're leasing the land, and so, you know, we put a lot of our income goes into labor expense of various kinds.
On the phone with us, Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swantonberry Farm, a certified organic strawberry farm in Davenport, California, and also a member of the Farm Workers Union. You're listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy. And Jim, I haven't had a chance to chat with you much, but because I've just been listening to the great questions.
You've been eating strawberries.
And I've been eating strawberries.
I kept asking you, and you just kept saying no.
And I just had my mouth full all the time.
Give me that basket.
Yeah, give you that. Now, Helga won't say anything.
Okay.
But I was wondering, is just real quick, Jim, without belaboring the point, what would be the difference for a strawberry worker just at another farm? What would be the difference in their life in compared to working under the conditions that you have? And then also, I'd like you just to talk briefly about the stock ownership program that you have.
Okay. Well, in answer to the first question, I would say that the range of the variation would be so huge that it would be really difficult.
Okay.
Because there would be some farms that do not have a union contract, but that do in fact pay health benefits, and they are a great place to work, and you know, good working conditions, and there would be very little difference. But there might be, you know, there's a full range of labor practices out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd probably, you know, leave that for another discussion
or
another
program.
But as far as the one thing that really is quite a bit different is that our farm is the only farm in the country, actually, production agriculture farm, that includes workers in the ownership structure through a mechanism called an employee stock ownership plan. And that kind of a plan is actually quite common in other industries, UPS and Southwest Airlines and Avis and various other companies around the country have significant ownership by employees through a stock plan. And some of them, I believe Avis is 100% owned by its employees. So it's not an unusual structure in American industry, but it is in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So it does give employees the opportunity to be a shareholder in the company. And so we instituted that about 5 or 6 years ago and have been slowly, incrementally increasing the share of the percentage of worker ownership in the company. And right now it's only 10%, but you know, we started with 0%, and
but you're the only farm that we know of in the nation that does this, where the farm is actually—
That's correct. There are a couple landscaping companies which, you know, are really not farms, but that's it, and there isn't any other in production agriculture.
And is that part of the payment plan, or is it the option of using money to buy stock, or what?
It's part of a bonus plan. So they don't actually purchase the stock. We have a profit sharing plan, and each year we put some stock, and in some years we put cash in addition to stock into that plan. And so it's in fact exactly a retirement plan for them. So they get tax sheltered income, and they acquire stock over time in the company. And it's open. It actually is very broadly based. All employees who work more than 500 hours are automatically part of the stock plan.
Fascinating. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jim, for being part of the show today. Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swanton Berry Farm, a certified organic strawberry farm in Davenport, California, and also the first to join the Farm Workers Union, and the only farm in the nation that has a co-ownership for farm workers of the operation itself. Thanks, Jim, for being part of the show. And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thank you very much again to our guests today, Rob Everts, co-president and co-executive director of Equal Exchange, a certification agency, and ensuring that our coffee, chocolate, tea, and bananas, among many other products, are grown culturally appropriate and socially just. And just on the phone with us, Jim Cochran, president and co-owner of Swanton Berry Farm. The websites, again, are equalexchange.coop. That's equalexchange.coop. And for Swanton Berry Farm, their farm stands, the location of the farm, and the farmers markets where you can find yummy, yummy Chandler's strawberry right now, certified organic strawberries, is swantonberryfarm.com. Thanks again for being on the show today, and thanks for all the fantastic work. Much appreciated.
An Organic Conversation is produced by our wonderful Heidi Hartley, production assistant, the outstanding Gina Rastani. Underwriting production is provided by The Ear, the one and only Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all. And also, always, thanks to the team here at Green 960, our very own Fab Four, Corey Calwert, Mark Magnone, Chris Gardiner, and Ricky Falaire.
Also, always, thank you, our listeners, for being part of this show and for actually listening. For our blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. And you can also find us now on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPhone or iPod to take us with you on the road.
You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Both look for An Organic Conversation. We would love to hear from you, so please send us your comments and questions to share at anorganicconversation.com.
We'll be back next week, Saturday at 10 a.m., with a great show on kombucha. What's the fuss all about? Kombucha, the power and benefits of fermented foods, next Saturday at 10 a.m. Now, what's the fizz all about,
that's
right?
That's what's the fizz all about, Jeff. That's right.
What's the fuzz? What's the fizz? Coming up here right after the hour is Your Supernatural Life with Beth Greer, a fantastic show on how to live a healthier, less toxic life. So please stay tuned for Your Supernatural Life with Beth Greer. We are your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening to An Organic Conversation here, where else, on Green 960. Race that I choose it. Like a good book, I can put this deep.